David Fowley, I hate gimmicks, which is why tonight, as we discuss The Fugitive from 1993, Andrew Davis's, I'm going to say it, action thriller masterpiece starring Harrison Ford, I'm going to take a page from Dr. Richard Kimball, the man who's on the run in Chicago because people thought that he killed his wife. He's a fine, upstanding surgeon. And he's got this nice, great, middle-aged Harrison Ford beard. But in order to protect himself from the authorities, he shaves it all off. He becomes Harrison Ford, I dare say. Like, he looks, at the end of this movie, he looks like he does in, like, every other movie he was in the 90s. I think he went right from the Regarding Henry set to the latter half of this movie. That's my theory. Anyway.
While he had the beard, he also managed to go to the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. So, yeah.
Well, there you go. And as I said, I abhor gimmicks, which is why I am going to shave off my beard using this this razor and these accoutrements. But while I prep, David, tell me about, you know, we've talked about a couple of Harrison Ford movies in the past. We talked about The Mosquito Coast last year, which was a revelation to me. I love that movie. I don't know which movie I love more because there are two different takes on Ford, but Harrison Ford's just the man. Let's face it. Tell me your first encounter with The Fugitive, either the Harrison Ford movie, the TV show that inspired it, and why do you love it?
So, thank you once again for having me. Yeah, I remember very vividly, it was summer of 93. Okay. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
August 93. And it's the same month that Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven came out. So it was a great month.
Right.
And I saw both of those movies at McClurg Court Theater downtown, Chicago, that is. And that was, you know, the place to see a summer blockbuster. I think I saw Jurassic Park there, episode one.
Jurassic Park episode one?
Yeah, not really. if only. Technically, it was Jurassic Park episode one. So there we go.
Yeah.
Counts. I feel like you're going white face on me. Anyway,
it's weird because the camera's flipped, so I have no idea what I'm doing here. I'm using my camera view as a mirror.
It's like we did like the pie in the face thing. Anyway, I'm shaving this coconut cream off.
It's blue. Yeah, it matches my shirt.
I was familiar with the show, probably. From, you know, you go through a period growing up in the 80s, or at least I did, where, you know, the TV's your babysitter and, you know, even during the day and stuff. And so there would be reruns, of course, of like Twilight Zone. I dug all these black and white shows, you know, from the kind of like the traditional Andy Griffith, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver.
Leave It to Beaver, yes.
And then there was The Fugitive. And I think I got into it because, and I don't know how or who told me, but I was really into The Incredible Hulk, which is basically The Fugitive.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Because, you know, Mr. McGee is always after David Banner, not Bruce Banner. And Sam Gerard is always after Richard Kimball, played by David Janssen. So I, you know, I think that around that time, probably late 70s, early 80s, I was just watching reruns of The Fugitive. And I dug it. It was cool. Cause it was just like, what's funny is like, he was just at each episode, he was just like helping out people, which was what Bill Bixby's David Banner was trying to do.
And the A-team, when you think about it.
Yeah.
Except he was like a gang of people on the run.
Right.
Help people, but with like smashing violence in that giant van. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What the Hulk had going for it is that awesome theme song at the end of each episode. Dun, 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 dun. Anyways, so when The Fugitive came out, I'm like, I thought it was really kind of brilliant timing just because everybody knew Harrison Ford, of course, but not enough people knew about the movie, or I'm sorry, the TV show, The Fugitive, around that time, 93. And so I was like, oh, this could be really interesting, but it could also be really bad, because how do you compile all these seasons into one movie. Well, you don't. And that's what was made the movie great. Now, for those in the know, there was a lot of improvisation in this movie. There was a lot of unscripted stuff in this movie. There was a lot of rewrites in this movie. This movie was the idea of a fugitive adaptation was in development for at least 5 years before 92 when it was filmed. I think it was Arnold? Is it Arnold Copelson was the producer? He was the one who was really trying to get it off the ground for years. Let me go to see what it says here. And, it took a while to get a good script. Arnold Copelson and Peter McGregor Scott co-produced this movie. The writers, David Toohey and Jeb Stuart. Toohey came up mainly with the story, but started the screenplay, but Toohey but Jeb Stuart wound up finishing it. And he did the screenplay for Die Hard. So a bunch of other things.
I did not know that, but that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, totally.
The lone kind of everyman who gets drawn into this chaotic world. But wow.
No, it's very fitting. And the script went through so many things because at one point they were thinking, summer blockbuster, he's got to have a love interest. And that idea right there is just stupid because he's mourning his wife who got murdered. Why would he have a love interest while he's on the run, while he's trying to, figure out who killed his wife? And I think that's why Julianne Moore got if you look at the billing, she's like second billing or third after Tommy Lee Jones. And so, when I was rewatching that, I was like, okay, well, why is that? I did a little research and they actually filmed scenes with Ford and Moore. Not like intimate scenes or anything, but just more screen time so they could develop something. Which is just totally
and justify
stupid.
That billing, yeah.
yeah. I remember when 93 was around the time I started kind of discovering Julianne Moore because I had seen her in Shortcuts and this movie, Todd Haynes movie, Safe. And I was like, oh, wow, she's like barely in this movie at the end there. And of course, Jane Lynch plays one of the doctors. It's very interesting now that you go back and see all these things.
Well, yeah, I mean, this movie is full of, it's character actor central.
Oh, totally.
I mean, you've got Dan Roebuck.
Yep.
I can't remember the actress's name, but do you ever watch that show Psych?
Yeah. Yeah.
The mayor chief of police from that show is in this movie for a scene. I think her name is Betty.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And L. Scott Caldwell, who was in a lot of things. She played she's in part of Tommy Jones' team.
The kid, the rookie kid who gets his ears, his hearing blown out. He was with Tommy Lee Jones in Under Siege, the other Andrew Davis
That's
movie
right.
from the year before.
That's right. And I mean, this is the third Tommy Lee Jones movie that Andrew Davis collaborated with him on. And the first What's one the other? Was first one was Gene Hackman and him was in, they were in The Package, also filmed in Chicago, and then Under Siege. What's odd is, and I can't imagine this happening, but it's kind of funny, is Harrison Ford was interested in The Fugitive because he thought that Under Siege was such a good movie. I'm like, okay. I thought Andy Davis did a great job and they're both Chicago guys. So it's all right, let's do this movie. And it was Andy Davis's idea to have the movie set in Chicago because he was familiar with it, because he grew up in Chicago, and it makes sense. Out of all the big cities in the Midwest, not to say this because this is where we live, but Chicago is just a perfect setting for this. Now, that being said, even in 93, when I saw this, I have always been a big stickler for how Chicago and Illinois, I guess, is represented in the movies. I just always thought it was funny. It's like, okay, you would imagine that he gets sentenced for the murder of his wife. You'd imagine that he'd be going to Stateville, or even if he went somewhere downstate, like you could clearly tell, okay, where would this dam be? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, and also even the small town. Now it's filmed, there's some parts filmed in, I think, Kentucky, but mostly North Carolina, northern North Carolina, just below the Smokies. So it, you know, I'm like, okay. You know, they said that, like, that even when Ford was contacting Nichols when he goes back into the city, he's like, where are you? I'll come get you. And he's like, St. Louis, and hangs up. So it's like, okay, maybe the prison was somewhere around St. Louis. Who knows? But
well, I think he was just making up a smoke screen to throw. Sure. Him
off, oh, yeah, right? Of course.
In case he was being tapped or something.
But, yeah. But you would think, like, if he did escape, you know, from prison or from the bus, that he would still be somewhere downstate. And nobody would think that he would come back to the city where the crime happened. But yeah, I mean, I think obviously, you know, you just kind of, as a Chicagoan, as a person who lives in a land of Lincoln, you just kind of got to gloss over these things. Yeah, I mean, I think like the production design is pretty amazing. The practical stunts, you know, they're, you know, that was a real train and that was a real bus. What's odd is how the bus it is a little silly when you think about it. It's like, let's back up a little bit, because Kimball gets the whole trial and the investigation is a little bizarre. Like, it all happens so quick. In fact, the first 15 minutes of the movie, there's still, and now it is spread out, but there's still opening credits going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's
and slow. It's jarring because they do disappear after a while.
After a while, and then they come back.
And then they pop back. Yeah. I'm like, wait, okay. Oh, the director of photography. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. And throughout the movie, we're getting flashbacks of bearded Ford wrestling the one-armed man. And, you know, so we kind of go back to that scene. The one-armed man's played by Andreas Katsoulis, who was also the bad guy in Someone to Watch Over Me by Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott, Blade Runner, full circle. Anyway. Yeah, so so it's kind of funny because, like, that whole investigation was really quick. You know, you're guilty, you're on the bus. One thing I was reminded of is that whole interrogation scene with the two cops, the very Chicago two cops, was improvised. It wasn't in the script.
And that, but it, still, it was very well done. One of my big contentions with this movie, and I don't have many big contentions, but the one guy with the huge glasses, and he had like the most, he was like the Chicago Bears super fan accent guy. He's like, what color were his eyes? You know,
what color was his hair? You could have your big contention, but at the time he was actually, this was a moonlighting gig. He was actually a Chicago cop.
That's fine. Yeah. But I can't have that guy having like this really cool introduction scene where he's interrogating Ford, because it is kind of surreal, because you hear him, his voice is almost in the background as Ford is like losing his mind. And he's like so callous, like, what color was his eyes? What color was his hair? Like,
yeah,
he doesn't really care. He thinks Ford is guilty.
Yeah, of course.
But to have him pop up later in the movie is like, he's supposed to think he's the badass. Like, if you see Dr. Kimball, you shoot him down on sight. I'm like, no, you got to get a Dennis Franz, you know, for that role.
Speaking of authenticity, that would have been great. Thinking of authenticity, you also have some like local Chicago reporters. You got John Bulldog Drummond reporting outside of Kimball's apartment. And
you have Lester Holt.
Later on, you have Lester Holt in, who's the other guy? Hang on, I got it somewhere here. Yes, you had Lester Holt and another one, Jay Levine, local Chicago newscaster. It's kind of cool. So, you know, I feel like this was good at the time for like Chicago filmmaking, for local actors, for local newsmen and local cops. But yeah, Ron Dean was also the cop there, and he's played so many Chicago guys.
He was in The Dark Knight, right?
With, yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
guy that Ledger pushes through the door into the party. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was, I think he was one of the dads in The Breakfast Club, and he was in Andy Davis's Above the Law with Steven Seagal, also in Chicago. Yeah, you know.
Wait, was Above the Law the one where they're driving and there's palm trees in the background? Was that a different one? Because that was the Chicago set one. I remember seeing that on Siskel and Ebert. Wow.
Oh, gosh. That movie. Oh, yeah. And, gosh, Pam Grier was in that. Henry Silva. But, yeah, it's I think, like, for those in the know, I mean, Andrew Davis, we know that he's always, you know, been really good about making movies in Chicago. You know, there was Chain Reaction with Keanu Reeves, Morgan Freeman. But yeah, I think the great thing about that interview scene is that it is improvised, and Ford did not know the questions that were to be asked, and they was just like, go ahead, ask him. And I'm impressed that you got through that. I mean, was your hair not that thick, or because I cannot do that with this. I need to start off with electric and then go blade.
But wasn't that thick? It was mostly a Van Dyke, but I've not been fully clean shaven in probably half a decade, I don't think.
All right, you're going to keep the Wolverine lamb chops? And
oh, of course. No, no, these are 90210 Dylan McKay sideburns.
Luke Perry, gosh.
Hell yeah.
R.I.P. I think that's when people started like wearing longer sideburns, is because of 90s.
Fun fact, when that show came out, I did not quite have the facial hair to grow out
the ability
sideburns. Right. So I wanted them. So I grew my hair out and I would trim it around the ears just so I could have long sideburns and then paste them down to the side of my face using ultra hold hair gel.
So it was kind of like a comb over thing going on.
It was a sideburn comb over. Exactly, David. I love it.
So anyways, at some point Kimball buys hair dye and his escape, like, okay, he does get injured, and he has to like sew himself up in a hospital, but he's a doctor, he can do that, right? And that's where he shoots himself in the butt, you know, with the, what do you call it, antibiotic or something. But I did think it was funny, and this was in one of the videos I sent you. He steals an ambulance, the most conspicuous vehicle you could steal. And then Tommy Lee Jones is immediately in a helicopter. He's like, there he is. Let's get around him. Come on. You know.
Well, yeah, but there's a proud tradition of people trying to escape in Illinois and stealing ambulances, aka Michael Myers and his trip from Haddonfield Haddonfield.
Maybe Kimball was thinking about that. Michael Myers can do it, so can I. Let's get away with this as well. But I was funny. I was watching this movie and my daughter kind of came into the room and I'm like, hey, hold on, watch this. This is the movie that I wanted to watch with you. And she's like, okay. She's looking at it. And she's like, is that Harrison Ford? He's so young there. I'm like, and as a scene, you know, the classic scene, I didn't kill my wife, I don't care. And she's like, he would have never survived that. And I found out and doing a little reading up on it. It was, I think they used like six or seven dummies. When they flopped off the, when he did a Peter Pan off the ledge.
I think I had not watched this movie in a long time. It might have been 15 years or more. For some reason in my head canon, I justified that because I think I made up a line where someone had said, how could he have survived that? And someone pulls up, oh, he was like a championship diver in school. That line I'm sure is nowhere in the movie, but in my head, that's how I pulled it.
That would have been awesome when they were like, weren't they flipping through like old pictures? Like it was either a yearbook or something, and they have like a picture of Ford in college. It would have been great, like, you know, most likely to become Olympic diver or something.
Well, the thing I noticed that stood out to me was that it was clearly, you know, someone's yearbook that has pasted a picture of Harrison Ford in.
Oh, it was.
It was a quick shot, but it's like everybody else on the page had like the close up of their face, and his is like more of a bust, and like the suit and tie is like really tiny. Like,
yeah, that was his photo from Ripon College in Wisconsin. So the other thing too is, you know, he's on the run. He, I would say, apart from like the injury on the side, everything is pretty much going good for him when he's on the run, right? I mean, it isn't, he's, there's some anxious moments, but at no point is his, I'm not going to say no point is his life in danger, because he did do the Peter Pan off there, but he survived. And, you know, he made a blanket full of leaves one night where he's dreaming about his dead wife. You know, and then he follows the river into town, and lo and behold, a tow truck driver parks and drops off his overalls. Oh, got a new pair.
That's exactly how Michael Myers did it.
Yeah. So,
except he killed the tow truck driver, but
yeah. That's right. Oh my gosh, that would have been amazing. That would have been great if, like, you have a scene where the tow truck driver, say that fast, comes, parks a car, drops the onesie, and Ford's Kimball is on his way up, and all of a sudden, you know, Michael Myers comes and takes it away. It's like, oh, geez, I had my chance. But yeah, it, what's funny too is that scene when he is shaving, it's in the hospital room of this old guy who's kind of like in a neck brace and pretty much kind of comatose. And he's like, he's the luckiest guy. I mean, he's got all these items. Yeah, he found some hair dye somewhere, but he's able to take time to shave. He's able to, while he's on the run, and he gets like a whole scrambled eggs and toast and eats it.
Well, yeah, because he took the guy's food. I mean,
I know. I mean, it's just so coincidental. It's like he's just in time for serving time. And
well, that's the thing is, I, you know, he is very fortunate, but a lot of what he does is it within the system that he works in professionally.
Sure.
You
so know, he knows.
Yeah. Yeah. He knows like when it's feeding time, he probably knows what kind of patients to go, right, you know, right, into his room to take some time to clean himself up.
He's looking at the chart. Oh, this guy's in a coma. He's not going to miss anything, you know?
And, right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's true. He does use his strength and knowledge in his mental. He does his mental gymnastics and gets his way in and out of situations.
But what I love is that he is a very solitary figure throughout this movie. He's not, he doesn't have anybody like a sidekick to monologue off of. We just see him doing his thing, right?
And that's,
for the most part.
And that's what's so smart about the script is that I think the writers realize that, like, okay, we need something to offset that. And that's why you had Tommy Lee Jones and his crew. Now, I would say that if it was just Tommy Lee Jones, Sam Gerard, it would only be two stories of two solitary characters in one story. But the fact that Jones is working off his team makes the movie to me. You know, the way when I say working off, he's got this back and forth banter with all these guys, and some of them are newbies, some of them are veterans. You got Joe Pants, Pantoliano. It just like so many lines that were improvised, the whole thing with the chocolate donut, think me up a coffee and a chocolate donut with the sprinkles, you know, that was improvised. I think in the line, it was just like in the script, it was just like, get me coffee, you know, but he was like, I'm thinking, well, think me up a coffee, you know, but just all those things. And, that really kind of offset this kind of solitary story of Ford that we're following. And it's interesting, but I mean, you'll have to admit that like the overall conspiracy that's being uncovered isn't all that interesting. I mean, it's a big pharma conspiracy thing and switching the samples, and it's like, you know. And
well, I mean, look, it's in 1993, I could see it not being very interesting, but today, I mean, when you look at, there's alternately an overtrust on Big Pharma and a high skepticism of Big Pharma because of things that have happened in the last couple of years. And in terms of corporate conspiracies, I think it was just this week you had the second Boeing Airlines whistleblower mysteriously die right before they were supposed to testify. I'm watching The Fugitive now, and I'm thinking, this is very prescient. I mean, yeah, there's the realm of conspiracy theory and everything, but it doesn't feel far-fetched considering what's in the headlines.
Yeah, it was also very timely for the early 90s. I mean, you had The Firm, Pelican Brief, and all these, you know, kind of, you know, all these kind of legal movies based off of books and stuff, and here we have this based off a TV show. Now, trying to think, but I can't think of anything like in the late 80s or early 90s where a movie was adapting a TV show this well. In fact, I would go on record saying this is probably the only good movie TV adaptation, but
it's it's way too late for me to in the day for me to think of a counterexample.
Right.
But you might be right. Now, here's the thing. I agree, and I think it's also just startling that the idea that you could say, "Hey, we want to dust off this franchise because there's some name recognition and make a big screen feature film," but still have this be in the era before everything was a mega franchise.
Because
this is a one and done movie. There's no indication at the end of like, "Oh, Kimball's still running." What?
Yeah.
Tell me.
U.S. Marshals.
That doesn't count. I never watched U.S. Marshals. Was that any good?
I remember seeing scenes of it. I don't think I've ever seen the whole thing of it, the whole way through. I couldn't get on board with Snipes' character. It was just like so silly. It's comical. It's actually Jones is Sam Gerard. We get to see him in the opening in a like a giant like fast food chicken outfit. Yeah. Like a mascot, like a fried chicken outfit.
I'm never watching this movie. I'm never watching that.
Yeah.
No.
But
I guess my point is like, it doesn't feel, I can understand U.S. Marshals becoming a thing a year or two later because like The Fugitive was this massive
success. And he won an Oscar for it.
Right. So it's like, hey, let's capitalize, let's do something with it.
Yeah,
but it's not like the people at Warner Brothers are like, okay, we're going to have Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones and it's going to be a 3-picture deal. And, you know, he's set up in the first movie and he's on the run until the third one.
Well,
and then we'll do spinoffs.
Well, that was one of the other things that Ford agreed to do the movie if it was just a one and done. Yeah. And it makes sense. You know, I mean, come on. For studios, for the producers, I'm sure they would think, but what do you mean? You know, the show had 7 seasons or whatever. It's like, no. I'm about to do a Jack Ryan. I'm about to, no. You know.
The thing that, I mean, first of all, I don't think I realized how much improvisation was in this movie. So when you tell me, or when I find out that the interrogation scene was improvised, I think that's why I responded to Ford's performance so intensely this time around, because he looks shaken. He's like, he looks like he's struggling to find the words and figure out what's going on. It's probably because he's assessing in the moment, okay, what would my character do and how do I react? And I'm upset and all this other stuff. And these people are accusing me. I can't believe what's going on. It's very moving. And the whole bit with him struggling with the one-armed man, his wife crawling to the phone and dying and calling out his name that last time.
Richard.
The scene later on in the hospital where he saves that little kid on the on the gurney. This is the first time I've really watched, I think, The Fugitive as an adult. It came out when I was a teenager. I thought, oh, it's cool. It's got some cool effects. And I like Tommy Lee Jones. He's crazy. And Harrison Ford's always great. But watching it now, I realize this is a movie about like adults with careers and lives and senses of duty. I watched, and I'm talking about this next week. I don't know if you'll be on the show. I'm talking about The Fall Guy next week.
Okay.
I saw that last night, and I recall, there are 2 references to the Fugitive in The Fall Guy.
Huh.
Watching The Fugitive today, I had a Will Smith moment regarding The Fall Guy. I'm like, you keep The Fugitive out of your damn mouth. Because
I was gonna say, who did you slap?
I slapped everyone involved with The Fall Guy. I think, as hot take, I think The Fall Guy is one of the worst movies of the year, especially in comparison to The Fugitive. Because looking at that Siskel and Ebert segment that you switched me on to, it's cool watching them talk for 5 minutes about it. They really put it into context, like this is a summer blockbuster thriller, but it's a movie where there are jokes, but they're incidental. They're like banter between, you know, Jones's crew, or, you know, some witticism he might come up with. It's not jokey. I don't get the feeling that I'm watching a bunch of like developmentally arrested man children. We're talking about a professional surgeon. We're talking about a U.S. Marshal, and they're chasing each other. And it's like a statewide manhunt for this guy. Whereas I watch Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, two performers that I really like, ostensibly playing adults, but in this thing where the entire movie is just like references to other movies and the action stopping every 10 minutes so they can have an 8-minute conversation about a relationship that we don't really have context for. This movie is 4 minutes longer than The Fall Guy, but it feels about 7 hours shorter than The Fall Guy.
Wow. Yeah, that's about right. maybe I could be there for that. So I think like over the years, like this is probably, let me think, probably Ford's best movie of the 90s. Yeah.
Cause what else was he was doing?
I mean, two Jack Ryans. He was in like Regarding Henry, as you mentioned, 6 days, seven nights. Oof. There was those, and then I think wasn't The Devil's Own in the 90s too?
Then 97,
yeah.
I think.
Wow. I think this is just it's a smart, mature thriller. It earns the kind of the third act climactic kind of like requisite kind of battle.
It's funny. I mean, I buy it because it's exciting and you really want this guy Nichols to get his comeuppance. For anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, that means you haven't watched The Fugitive, which why are you watching a podcast about The Fugitive? And how have you not seen The Fugitive yet? But so this guy Nichols was a doctor a colleague who was being essentially paid by this pharmaceutical company to help develop this miracle liver drug. And they got it passed. They're going to make $1 billion out of it. The problem is Nichols took the research that Kimball, Ford's character, had submitted regarding this stuff. Hey, this actually does lots of damage to the liver. We cannot put this out on market. It would be irresponsible. Right. Nichols took the research, swapped out the samples.
Switch to make the it samples. Look like,
right. You just moved the tombstones to make it look like, oh, it's a perfectly safe and effective drug and we can put it out there. And then when Kimball was an inconvenience, they sent the one-armed man to do the assassination, and turns out the wife was there. I guess I don't think we ever got an answer to like why Helen. You know, I think that's
what's funny too is like they knew he was at a dinner, and then he was called to surgery. So his wife goes home, and that means that the one-armed man was just like sitting there in the closet waiting for either of them. And I don't know. I guess when Kimball didn't show up, he's like, well, I'm here. I guess I'll kill a wife, you know?
Okay, David, I like to, I know you sent me a video, a CinemaSins video. It's like 20, why The Fugitive sucks in 20 minutes.
No,
the video
is
in 21 and a half minutes. It's like, okay, all the problems with The Fugitive and stuff.
It is,
but I'm saying, yes. You can pick apart this movie till the cows come home. The one thing was like he was running out the building and the guard like reached over the desk to grab him. Like, why didn't he step out? Because the guy was running right past him. Anyway,
that was funny though. But yeah, I mean, some of this stuff is just like they're not even sins. They're just funny. But yeah,
the one sin I pointed, I didn't watch the whole 20-minute video. I scrubbed through it. But the one thing that I saw later in the movie, there is a newscast of like Richard Kimball's in Chicago and he's back and there's a manhunt. They show the picture of the trial and they show the reaction shot of when the judge slams the gavel. Like, okay, that's from the movie. There's no news camera
that?
Like at the judge's bench, like filming his reaction.
Let's film this. And it's like, how, I mean, I guess it's not like he was a famous local doctor. I mean, I guess just because it's like, it's a murder, you know, the doctor killed his wife. That's the biggest thing, you know. I don't know. Why does it make such big headlines? Because it's in a movie. Yeah.
It's probably because of the, like, the brutal killing, and he maintained it's a very sexy story because he maintains his innocence, but all signs are pointing to, he bashed her head in. And
But it's funny because there's really no other Chicago detective like doubting anything or working another angle until the U.S. Marshal comes in. You know, there's something hinky here. You know what? I don't want you using that word. But
now, also, was Gerard and his team, were they called in because of the train?
Yeah, because of the because of escaped U.S. Marshals are called in when there's escaped fugitives, when there's escaped prisoners.
Okay, I wasn't quite sure how the like if that was if there was some other reason they were involved in.
And that's the thing is, see, if you watch the sequel, you know this, Ian. Wesley Snipes is a fugitive on the run, and you know he's. So U.S. Marshal
escapes on the plane and becomes passenger 57.
Kind of is, actually.
Oh no.
Yeah. Anyway, the whole thing with Nichols, and Nichols is was played by Richard Jordan. He filled some scenes there, but he developed a brain tumor and shortly died prior to the fugitive being released. Sadly, so he was recast by Yeroun Krabbe. I had to practice that because, you know, a Dutch actor, us Americans would say Jerome Crab, but it's Jeroen Krabbe. And when I saw this, I was like, oh, where's this villain from The Living Daylights been? Because that was at the time, that was probably the movie that I've seen him in before. He was good. I mean, it was very, even like in interviews I saw with him, is like he was called up. He showed up, he went to wardrobe, and then was like given the script. So it was very on the fly, like,
and it was improv.
Yeah, I mean it was filmed in like 70 something days, and they had a hard release date of August 93. I don't know why, but that's what Warner Brothers did. And I think that it kind of, this looseness of everything really kind of worked in the film's benefit, because It, for one thing, although the movie is very structured, it doesn't feel very stiff. It's very loose and organic, I think. That scene that you mentioned when Kimball helps out that little boy, Joel. I would love to see like more scenes where he's just showing up at hospitals, reading charts, and no, this guy needs this. How did this guy know that? But no, you need to operate here. So he saved the boy's life. And I love that. And you probably noticed that watching it now as an adult, that just this camera is on Kimball, just like proud that he actually got to do that and help out the boy. Like, it's like a little smirk, you know?
Well,
it's cool.
Yeah. And it's, but it what I was talking about before, I don't think I quite finished my point, is watching this movie as an adult and as a dad, you really get to feel, you get the sense that Harrison Ford, he's not a superhero. He's just a doctor. And he's like this noble kind of doctor who likes to work on people and help people and do good things. He's at a charity event when we first meet him. He's like kind of like the Bruce Wayne of Chicago or something.
Right.
He loves his wife. He's got a great relationship. So you just get the feeling that he's a good person and everyone thinks that he's a killer. And so he just wants to keep on doing the only thing that he knows how to do, which is survive and help people. What I loved is that I hadn't really picked up on this, is that he doesn't decide to go after the one-armed man until waking up in that pile of leaves after surviving the train crash and all that, right? Because he has that dream of his wife, and then he has that dream of, you find this man, of him like in the interrogation room. And he's like, you know what?
That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And it's just, but again, he doesn't wander into town and tell somebody, I'm going to go on a mission of vengeance and clear my name. He just does it. He gets right to the point and he does it.
I appreciate the fact that, and we do gather that, like at no point is he telling anybody else in the movie, like, I'm going to clear my name. It's more about his silent mission of finding, you know, bringing to justice the killer of his wife. There's a lot of great Chicago scenes. And what I appreciate about how Davis shoots Chicago, you know, apart from, yeah, there is the Picasso there, but we got to talk about the Irish St. Patrick's Day parade, which is a better use of it than in the parade that we saw in Ferris Bueller. But of course, that was unscripted too. But I do like certain locations, like when they track down the other escapee. The big black guy.
I got you, man.
I know. Yep. I don't bargain. And then the scene when on the south side, when they're in that, they go in the police kind of raid the apartment that he's in, where he has this little basement apartment that he's renting out from this Polish lady, and her son is, you know, getting into, I don't know, it was like drugs. He's
selling drugs to 12-year-old girls.
Yeah, there you go. Awesome. But you feel that anxiety because he thinks the police are coming for them. And I remember when I first saw that, and I was thinking, I'm like, whoa, what's going to happen? Now he's going to get captured, but no. And I like the way that's filmed because you actually feel it.
That was almost a riff, intentionally or not, but on the Silence of the Lambs, the big climactic thing where the cops are, you think they're coming to her aid, but they're raiding a completely different house. Also, I got to say, the one moment where I cringed and it hurt to watch this movie, I can forgive it because it's a summer blockbuster, but it's a moment that is, the movie does not deserve this moment. When Ford finally, or Kimball finally confronts the one-armed man on the train, another character actor, Neil Flynn from the sitcom The Middle. Mm-hmm. He's like 20 years old in this movie, and he's the CTA cop that gets involved in this. Everybody's in this movie.
Yeah.
Beats the crap out of the one-armed man, handcuffs him to the train so he can be arrested later, and he says, "You missed your stop." I'm like, oh.
Ah.
No.
And it was funny, out of all the lines that like Jones and Ford like rewrote a lot of lines, it's like, all right. Oh, we forgot. He was also in Air Force One, like Get Off My Plane in the 90s. So that was like, you missed your stop. Get off my plane. You know,
get off my train.
Oh, my gosh. That's so funny. And I think Neil, would you say Neil Flynn, the actor? That's his name. He was in that show. I think he was in Scrubs, too. But I don't
probably know. He's been in a lot of stuff.
Yeah. A lot of stuff. But, you know, eventually in that third act, the subway scene's interesting too, because the movies always get the subway train stops, even in, especially in The Loop, they get it a little hinky. But for the most part, Davis does a good job, I think, at utilizing like the Chicago mise en scène without, you know, tourist trademarks, you know.
They're not hanging off the Sears Tower or anything like that. No. You know, it's pretty good. I mean, they got the Chicago Hilton in there, but I do think it was a missed opportunity to have that fight happen on the Brown Line, because then the cop could have come out afterwards saying, "I got Kimball on Kimball."
Sorry. That would have been perfect. Or there's a moment where you see the train. There's an aerial shot of the train going by the Harrison Hotel downtown, and it's on its way to Kimball. It's the Kimball Brown Line. Yeah.
And then there was some other. Oh, I think it was in the Siskel and Ebert review. They mentioned Ford making his escape. I just thought of the Ford escape. another. Possibly shared universe with Adventures in Babysitting, which also took place in Chicago.
Yeah.
You remember that movie?
Yeah.
There's that scene where they get on the L train, and the kids get caught between the two Chicago gangs. The Hispanic gang leader was the guy sitting on the train across from Ford reading the Sun Times, who went and tipped him off the cop.
That's right.
I like to think that was like, okay, this is, you know, it's like 8 years later, the guy's turned his life around. He got out of crime. Still riding the train.
He's still riding the train. Yeah, this was like around the same time Kathleen Turner was in V.I. Warshawski. It was also filmed in Chicago. Oh my gosh, it's hilarious. great trivia bit there. James Newton Howard did the score. I thought that was like, you know, a propulsive score, but also had a good balance to it. It didn't feel like, you know, overbearing in any way or trying to like be a John Williams thing. It felt like very kind of a very early 90s, you know, kind of action thriller type thing. That was, you know, I enjoyed it.
They also sidestepped, you know, speaking of propulsion, these movies tend to have like they race towards the big climax, and usually you've got the main villain like falling off a building or getting thrown into a helicopter blade or something. Both the antagonists in this movie survive, strangely enough. Die Hard moment where, you know, Nichols rises up and takes aim and, you know, Tommy Lee Jones shoots him or something like that. Even the one-armed man, the guy who killed Helen,
right,
is allowed to live.
I felt bad too, like at the end during that. Isn't it like a laundry room hotel chase in I think the Chicago,
is the Hilton,
the Hilton, yeah. There's a kind of like a cat and mouse chase in the laundry room or something, or boiler room. And poor Joey Pants gets conked in the head by that thing.
That was really well shot.
It was.
It wasn't filmed in like dramatic action movie thing where it goes flying at his head.
It was just quick.
It feels like it was quick, but it felt like it just got enough momentum. It's this heavy beam. It just knocks him out. Like, it hurt watching that. That was the second time I cringed, but for a good reason.
And I also like, too, is, like I said, we see these two stories. You see Gerard's team investigating this, and we see, you know, Ford investigating, you know, his own, trying to get to the bottom of his wife's murder. I really like the gradual kind of awareness that Gerard has, and it's probably one of the reasons why he won the Oscars, because he's so good in this. But it dawns on him that Kimball's innocent. You know, he learns, you know, eventually that, you know, this isn't our guy. And maybe they find out, they realize what Kimball's doing. Like, why would he come back here? You know, why would he, you know, they when they find him in the, when they, well, he's not in his apartment, but what they find, these remnants in an apartment, you know, he's making an ID and doing all this stuff. And he's clearly trying to get to the bottom of it. And that's, I like the fact that the way Jones plays Gerard, kind of coming to this realization, because at the end, the one scene that Ford and Jones have, I think, is in the back of the police car or something, like,
here, there's your love story.
Here, let me untie the, unlock the handcuffs, and you okay? You need anything?
I was waiting for him to say I care or something.
I thought
like
you
that,
didn't but... care. You know, I know. Yeah. Well,
the thing is, what I liked about the Gerard character, the way he was written and certainly the way he was performed, but, you know, when he says, I don't care, you do get that feeling like the only thing he gives a crap about is bringing in his man.
Yeah.
Now, as he learns that Kimball is innocent, I think that, I don't know that that really affects his job. Are there any situations that, whether or not he thought he was guilty or innocent, you think he would have acted differently throughout the course of the film? The only thing I can think of is he gradually starts to uncover, at the same time Kimball does, the conspiracy with McGregor Pharmaceuticals. But I don't think that necessarily affects the way he would deal with Kimball. If anything, he might say, you know, when I'm done with this Kimball case, I got some friends over at the DOJ or the FDA who might be interested to know about this hinkiness going on.
Yeah.
It's like, I can refer this case. This is interesting, but I've still just got to get this guy. I don't care if he did it or not.
Well, I think at some point it turned into like, I don't want to capture him. I want to prevent him from doing himself more damage. You know what I mean? Because especially towards the end in that kind of chase scene, it's like, I think Gerard's more interested in preventing Kimball from doing more damage, you know, to, you know, his status, let's say. And that's, It was that's it's good directing, and crazy enough, there's six editors in this movie.
I was going to mention
I don't
that. That was the first
understand
note I
that.
took on this movie.
I'm like, what the heck? But it's the first time, like, and it won. Well, it didn't. I mean, it won some Oscars, but that was the first time in Oscar history that editors, six editors were nominated for best editing. Crazy.
Did they win?
I know. I don't think they won, but
Damn
yeah.
it.
And you know, of course, we said Gerard won. Ford was nominated for a Golden Globe, but lost to Tom Hanks, Philadelphia. Yeah, it's understandable. But yeah, I mean, I think you know, it's just a really good, it's really good material. You know, you it's one of those movies where you just go with, and you shouldn't think too hard about it, or you'll find sins.
Well, I mean, but that's here's the thing. I am typically, I like to think, and I'm sure you can attest to this, alert to things and prone to nitpick. But aside from a less than a handful of details, I didn't pick up on any like major flaws or problems. I still don't think they're really flaws or problems. They're nitpicks. Like you can watch this movie. I think it works if you're thinking about it. It also works if you turn off your brain. But you don't have to. It's for what it is, it's a very smart movie.
But if we go back to the summer of 93, none of us were thinking about this stuff. You know, none of us were thinking about flaws because we were invested in a movie. We were following these characters, and they won us over. The script won us over, the directing, the performances, of course. Yeah, it's just, and I like that, you know, they have, of course, there's humorous moments with mostly with Gerard and his crew. But I like that scene when they're in the hospital and they're just outside the what do you call it, the prosthetics department, which I didn't even know some hospitals have those departments, but I thought that would be like, I mean, maybe back then, but it's just funny. It's like, why else would he be in the hospital? And all of a sudden this one-armed patient goes through. It's like, and it's just kind of convenient. It's like, no, we're not following you, dude. No, go ahead.
The other two details involving hallways randomly is when right after Kimball is freshly shaved and he's kind of stolen some doctor's like a lab coat and he's rushing down the hall
And
and
the
the cop
cop.
comes the other way and he's like I'm looking for a guy who's 6 foot or something, brown hair or whatever. He's like, you see a guy like that wandering around? And Kimball's like, every time I look in the mirror, pal, I'm like, oh my
Except the
God, this is
beard.
so good,
Yeah,
right?
he goes,
The
except the
other
beard.
one, that I forgot about, but I laughed out loud was the moment when he's escaping. Kimball had gone to the Department of Corrections to interview the one guy because he had a prosthetic limb. Turned out it wasn't him.
I love
He's
that guy in
escaping.
there too. Hey
Yeah,
man,
he's
you're here.
like,
Why don't we talk?
got nothing else going on.
You go
But
ahead.
no, he's leaving and Gerard spots him and he begins chasing him. And then Ford gets ahead and he goes out into the lobby and there's a bunch of cops there. And he says, officers, there's a guy in a blue coat. He's like yelling crazily, waving a gun around. And there's a woman.
And there's a woman. It's like,
And
well,
2 seconds later,
because
Tommy
you said
Joe.
there's a woman, we're gonna get involved, you know. Like he doesn't say there's a woman with him or there's a woman in danger. It's just like, and there's a woman.
Yeah. He almost mutters it. And then Jones comes around the corner, just like, get that man, get it, and everything, tackle him.
I read recently this week that like Jones did not like, he didn't believe that Gerard would just start shooting in like City Hall there. And I understand that, but I think like the screenwriter Jeb Stuart like really tried to persuade him because he's like, okay, what are the optics here? Because you had no problem shooting that other fugitive that you just shot down, you know, the taller black guy. I think the character's name is Copeland or something like that. You had no problem shooting that guy down in one scene in cold blood, and then you're having a problem shooting this guy in a public place.
That's weak sauce
That's
because
weak
the
sauce.
guy
That's a
had,
little different.
Right, because Copeland had had a U.S. Marshal at gunpoint, and was threatening to blow his head off.
Right,
whereas Kimball had just, he was unarmed as far as we knew.
Yeah,
the one thing from CinemaSins that I thought was pretty funny was, why didn't Gerard just shoot his foot? Because the foot got jammed in the door.
He's a bad shot. You know, he's a bad shot. But I love that, like, that response that, like, you know, Ford's so good at this. It's just like this everyman response of like, I could have just got shot. You know, there's a bullet right in front of me. It's crazy. And then of course he goes into the St. Patrick's Day parade. Again, unscripted, but it's so funny because the train wreck happens, I think, at the end of January, and then this whole time, up until really St. Patrick's Day, because that's all in one day, I think, isn't it? Or does the Hilton thing happen the next day? Because once he's in Chicago, it's all like boom, boom, boom.
Well, I mean, there might be some time lapse there because he does. He has to go find an apartment. He gets the money from Nick.
Right.
Then
right.
he has to go find an apartment.
Yeah.
You get the feeling he's probably looked at other places. He's got to sign a lease. Like, they skip a lot of paperwork in this.
I guess the moment from City Hall, I mean, is like it's all kind of boom, boom, boom. You know, they're tracking him down. But I just love that scene at the pharmaceutical convention. It's like, I don't know. I like scenes in movies where like the climax is like in a big kind of like dinner or auditorium or something. And it's like, you did this, you know, and the guys at the podium who's guilty and he, you know, or guy or girl, they can't go anywhere. They're like, security, this guy's clearly, you know, it's like, there's always, Dr. Kimball.
But I like the way that the Davis put us into that scene as if we were people at tables 10 spots back from where the action is happening, because it's not like Ford and the other guy are mic'd up. The one guy's at a mic because he's at the podium, but as he comes down, they start to go settle this thing off stage. You get that sound. We've all been in like big halls or something where someone is, their mic's not working, so you can hear they're saying something, but it's very echoey and kind of like faint. They do that same thing here. Mm-hmm. We're privy to it, but you can just imagine people in the back like, what the hell's going on up there?
And it's funny because there is somewhere in the room there's a guy with a spotlight. and he's following both of them, because once Kimball gets to the stage, they go off stage, and Nichols wants to get out of there, and the spotlight's going, nope, let's stay on these guys, you know.
I think it might be a callback to the opening credits. The weirdest opening credits I've seen in any film, because it says Harrison.
I know.
Ford.
And it like flips. The letter's like four. And it's like Tommy Lee Jones. And then they do the same thing with The Fugitive. And then later on, you know, again, these opening credits kind of drag out. And then it's just like at the bottom, Julia Moore, this and that. You know, it's like, the other bizarre thing, the funny, bizarre thing at the end. There's fireworks in the sky at the end. I don't know why. Like, we see, we're right by on Michigan Avenue, I think. And like the camera's like going up, and it's like there's fireworks. Now again, this is August. This is around a time where maybe this is coming from Navy Pier or whatever, but like,
but in the movie continuity, it's supposed to be
why would it be
St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah, well, why would it be?
maybe the whole thing is just like a running joke of Chicago, because you know the memes of Chicago weather, it's you get summer, spring, fall, and winter all in one afternoon.
it's like why are there, and I'm like, why did Andy Davis decide that? Like, I'll have to listen to the commentary. It's like, yeah, these fireworks, so we added these in post, and I don't know. But
a commentary like you might find here on this this 4K Blu-ray from Warner Brothers.
Nice transition there.
Yeah.
I have to say, I don't know if you watched it with the intro.
No.
So I chose to watch it with intro. Watch that intro, because it is terrible. It's a really bad intro. It's not like a recently shot like intro, of course, you know, because Ford's busy playing Red Hulk or something. But you know, it's like they edited, one of the editors edited like something from like a DVD special feature stuff where it's like clips. It's not a real intro to a movie, really. It's like clips from a conversation from a DVD special features from like the whatever the 90s. And it's so awkward and weird. It's like, there is no reason. Just start the movie. I don't know.
Well, it's not as bad as, did you ever listen to the Cameron Crowe Say Anything audio commentary?
No, I have not. That's pretty bad.
I've never heard it all the way through because it's so long that I stopped after 40 minutes because when you play the movie with commentary, this is on a Blu-ray or DVD from like forever ago. So I don't know if they kept it, but when you press play with commentary, it's like a slideshow of stills from the movie. And it's like, hi, I'm Cameron Crowe. I'm here to talk about Say Anything. And he keeps talking about the movie.
Even before the movie started?
Yes.
So it literally is an intro.
Yes. But it's him talking. Yeah. It's like,
here's my Polaroids from the set.
But it's, you don't see him. It's just like a PowerPoint presentation of the movie and he's talking over it. It's very strange. But yeah, so I love that movie and I love Cameron Crowe, but even I have my limits. Anyway, speaking of limits, I think I've successfully disguised my identity.
I couldn't tell.
Yeah. It feels weird.
Yeah, your wife's going to be like, I thought you were just doing a podcast.
No, she knew about it. She didn't try and talk me down from the ledge. I think she's ready to see me look a little different.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you, David, for talking about The Fugitive with me. I love this movie. I appreciate this more than I ever have, honestly.
It's a great movie. It's fun. I don't know what else really to say about it, except kind of surprised if people haven't seen it, but maybe I shouldn't be. But
let me ask you this, because I was shaving while you were talking about The Fugitive, the TV show. So I was a little distracted. How would you say this stacks up? Like, would you recommend seeking out the TV show and watching it as a companion piece, or is this such a unique to its own, you know, it's its own thing aside from the character names?
It is thankfully its own scene, own thing. I mean, it's taking the overall conceit of the show and kind of compartmentalizing it and, you know, shrinking it down to, you know, a 2-hour blockbuster. I would say if you're curious about it, it's worth checking out. A couple episodes or so. I've never seen the final episode because the final episode was huge, big ratings. Like, up until then, the only show that had a final episode that had more, you know, big viewership or ratings was the final episode of MASH. But the final episode of The Fugitive was him actually, you know, finding the one-armed man and you know, bringing in the justice. I mean, David Janssen is a pretty good actor. It's just he's more of like one of those like journeyman type actors. You know, he's there to do his part and everything. Funny thing in the courtroom scene in this movie, I learned that David Janssen's mother is sitting in the courtroom scene when right behind Kimball when they're playing the 911 call that from his wife. But it's like, how would you know that without knowing that? You know, it's like,
it's trivia.
But it's then I didn't do enough research. Like, I didn't know why is his mom there and not David Janssen? Did he die before this movie came out? I don't know. But
find out the answer?
I did not, but I got guess I could look right now, but I'm not gonna.
No, we'll leave that to the. You tell us, and we're not going to look it up. You leave a comment and tell us if David Janssen, if he's not still alive, was he when this movie was made, and why is his mom there for some reason?
Yeah, it's like some kind of, hey, mom, I could get you in a movie.
Was it David Janssen in disguise as his own mother because he was actually on the run from the cops?
That would be very Norman Bates of him.
All right. Well, David Fowley of Keeping It Real, thank you again for hanging out and talking The Fugitive and putting up with me shaving. Folks out there, if you liked this show, give it a like and a thumbs up and a subscription and all that stuff. And be sure and follow David Fowley at Keeping It Real. All his info is below. If you haven't seen The Fugitive, fix that right away. You can, the 4K from Warner Brothers is pretty nifty. It looks great. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of extras on it, although you can probably avoid the intro from what David is recommending. Yes. Now I got to watch it just so I can cringe some more. But anyway, I think that's about it. We have found this man, and by this man, I mean the discussion about The Fugitive. So till next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much and take care. Why did I point? That was so stupid.
I don't know. Yeah. But you're pointing because it's a Harrison Ford movie. I didn't care. Kill my wife. You find that man. He's pointing to Ron Dean.
Get off my podcast.